Joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon is author Joseph Abraham. He is many things. I hesitated over that, Joe, because you are a doctor, you're a writer, you're an educator, you wear many, many hats, scarves, and your career has been pretty astonishing. You're here in the role of author today because your book has just been published by the UL Press. It's called Kings, Conquerors, Psychopaths, From Alexander to Hitler to the Corporation. I think any of us who know the UL Press are always astonished, particularly in the fall when their titles and books start coming out, because of the quality, the breadth of subject matter that you can find in their catalog. And your book is certainly adding to an interesting historical, sociological component of their offerings. So it's a very meaty book. There's a lot to talk about in here, lots of history, lots of fascinating historical characters. But I think before we get into some of the individuals, I think we'd like to hear just a bit about your background. In addition to your medical training, you also have a number of other degrees. And would like to know, what is it that you studied? What do you think about? Were you created so that you were interested in writing a book like this that has to do with history, and particularly some very difficult parts of history?
Well, a lot of this deals with, I do have a background in evolutionary biology. I have published in that area, and I've been involved with this community. This is an amazing— the word unique is used improperly, but this is a unique community. And one of the major things that happened when I was an undergraduate here, I was trying to figure out why this place was so different than everywhere else I had lived. And Daryl Felder, retired from the biology department, kind of— we were talking about this university and others, and he said, well, this other university tends to be a hierarchy, and this place is a network. And that's really got me to start looking on this whole line at this whole idea of vertical organizations versus horizontal organizations, which are societies and communities. That fed into it. Some of the ideas started when I was actually 7 years old. That's a long story, but it was during the president—
precocious child.
Well, I still have insomnia. I'm sitting here kind of— anyway, I have some insomnia, and when I would lie in bed when I was a kid, and I was trying— there was the Johnson Goldwater campaign, and I was trying to figure out, well, who's right?
And as a 7 year old, you were pondering that at midnight.
Well, you can't sleep. You've got to do something. You're a good kid. You stay in bed, so you just start thinking. And what I realized is that you can't know who's right. And so the next question I moved on to, then, why do we all think we know? And then from there, why are we all crazy? So, you know, did that. Daryl Felder did. One of my mentors that I mentioned in the acknowledgments was Mate Alain, our good friend, who took me under her wing and forced me to go see a lot of movies at the Bayou Bijou and talked about ideas in history. And my medical training, I began to realize as I was looking at these kings and conquerors, that they fit a lot of our psychiatric definitions for some of the most evil people that lived. So that's a bit of what went into it, a lot of different threads.
Well, it sounds like your mode of thinking is quite a network and quite it goes horizontal and vertical. You're kind of all over the place. But it also sounds like you made great use of your university time and were really well educated beyond just the classroom and made use of the professors here and the opportunity that we have at UL to have discussions with professors.
I think there's a lot of truth to that, but I think that some of the people who later became good friends of mine would have liked to have killed me as a student. I'm not a quick start. I'm not a sprinter. I'm a hiker. And so they stayed friends with me, as you know. That's one of the wonderful things about our community and our university. Still, some of my best friends are the people who taught me. I mentioned Vaughn Baker in there and Amos Simpson. You know, a lot of the education I got from them was after they they were thoroughly disgusted with me as a student, I think, but they stayed good friends.
Well, persistence, that is a wonderful quality. And, I'm sure that they were more impressed than perhaps you were aware of when you were 19 years old.
Perhaps.
At that persistence.
But I was a difficult student.
But it sounds like your interests were varied, not just science, not just pursuing a career in medicine, but understanding the human condition. And you sound like history was very important to you, that you read about it, you thought about it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember when I started taking history classes in school, and I would ask my teacher, well, why should we study history? And what it took me couple of decades to realize was that history is to the citizen what the laboratory and the library are to the scientist. By looking at history, we can understand better who we are and what we're doing today. I always were sort of scattershot in my interests. I minored in French here. I have a minor in art. I have a minor in chemistry. I would love to go back and take math and philosophy and sociology and psychology and economics and...
Well, there's still plenty of time, Joe, now that you've finished this book especially.
There are more coming. Yeah. I have them lined up behind this
you
one.
You have lots of time at midnight now instead of writing this book to be studying. Well, so I think people get a sense of your wide and varied interests. History fascinated you. Characters, leaders fascinated you. Their psychology fascinated you. How did you begin shaping the idea of looking more closely at some of the kings, conquerors, and psychopaths that you talk about in this book?
Yeah, the historians are pretty familiar with this idea, but when you start looking at this guy, at these people, the great people of history, you realize that all of our fairy tales, our movies, our books, where the king and the conqueror are presented as great men who are noble and magnanimous and wise and kind, are just not true. In fact, they were the opposite. They were the worst criminals in history. Take a Ted Bundy or a Charles Manson and multiply them a million times, literally a million times, because the king, the conqueror, would gladly kill a million people for money and power. That is the king's game, and we kind of have lost this. The historian knows it, but the rest of us have not.
Hmm. So how did you go about organizing, creating a book around that idea? Who did you know you wanted to look at, study, present in this book? Were there particular kings and conquerors that you knew you really wanted to cover?
I knew that Adolf Hitler was more revealing about history than we realized. There were certainly unique things about him, but I realized it was a pattern over and over. My inspirations, while I was writing on this, I was thinking about our friend Ernie Gaines and his comment. I wrote books that I wanted to read, and this was pretty much what I was doing. I started 20-something years ago just jotting interesting notes down as I would read. And slowly I started massaging it into I didn't even know for a long time that it was going to be a book. Just started massaging the information into things that started to look like chapters. And amoeboid-like it emerged.
Some of those notes, what it feels to me like is you go deep beneath the gloss. You break the gloss, and you pull out those details of the conquerors and kings that we don't often get in the history books. And so you are writing it for yourself and others who've always wanted to know, well, what did that mean? Alexander's armies conquered most of the known world. That's mostly the sentence we take away from our history books. But you go way past that and talk about numbers and kinds of slaughter. And so were these some of the notes you've been taking over the past 20 years, trying to gain an understanding of that psychology of the conqueror?
To a certain extent, yes. What happened was I started to see these patterns, and I began to suspect they had to always be true. How does one man hold 10 million, 50 million, 100 million, a billion people? How does he control them except by just ruthless brute force? So even though I only had a handful of examples to start, when I got to the chapter on conquerors, which is about a fourth of the book, what I started doing, the internet's wonderful. And believe it or not, I started with a lot of popular stuff. I have a children's book on atrocities, and I would kind of flip through it, and then I would find something stated, and then I would go see if I could actually find that in serious sources. And sometimes you couldn't. Sometimes it was not substantiated. But occasionally something I read on a piece of fluff turned out to be really accurate, spot on, and I just kept reading and digging and digging and digging. And as I threw out the offer in the book that you can take any king, any conqueror who was a real king or conqueror, Google or do an internet search for that person with atrocity, massacre, something, and you'll start getting hits. It's true for all of them.
Well, I mentioned Alexander, but maybe for the benefit of people listening, can you mention some of the other groups and historical figures that you look at in the book?
I tried to offend everybody. I really did. I literally realized I was focusing too much on Western Europe, so I looked at Shaka Zulu in South Africa. He was horrific. I looked at Atahualpa, who's always presented a bit of a victim when Pizarro goes in, but Atahualpa was just horrifically vicious. I look at the Americans. We certainly are not driven snow. I look at Asia. I looked at Ashoka, this great conqueror of India, who is so tied up in their heritage. And of course, a lot of what we know about him is probably exaggerated and mythical, but it's the same stories over and over and over. And then I found this great book that just lists the guy did – it's a reference book, Atrocities by Matthew White, I think his name is. And he just goes through massacres in history and documents what different historians have said and how many people they estimate died. So who did I leave out?
The
probably
Greeks?
The Athenians, the Hebrews, yes. Mm-hmm. The early Christians. Mm-hmm. One of the fascinating ones is after Constantine. Constantine was horrifically nasty butcher. And after he and his sons converted the Roman Empire to Christianity, I found a comment that within a few years after that, more Christians were killed by fellow Christians than had been killed in the 300 previous years under Roman persecution. Everybody's implicated.
The first part of the book, as I think people are beginning to get a sense of, is you really want us to break through that sense of comfort and admiration for some of these groups and individuals in history whose story is told by the beautiful statues, the beautiful paintings, the beautiful poems that come down to us through history, but that there's another part of how they got to those moments.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it becomes one of the questions. So if the men we thought were great and wonderful and virtuous were actually the most vicious criminals in history, how did we come to believe these things that are the exact opposite of what they are? And so one of the things I point out is that to survive, our ancestors had to agree with what the king said, and not just agree, they needed to believe it. And so when we look – and one of the legacies we have today is that when we look at political parties or nations or religions or football teams who sit there and attack one another, they can see the hypocrisy on the other side. They can see the gullibility on the other side, and they say, look at those stooges, and it never occurs to them, we're all playing this game where we're listening to our leaders, political leaders, government leaders, corporate leaders, they lie to us and we don't question it. We believe it.
So how did you take that trajectory? I mean, you're dealing with a lot of issues here and some very serious questions. You go from far history and you start to bring it more up to the present, and that must become a little more difficult because you do start touching upon things that seem more familiar, things that we think are common in our world. You know, to hear about slaughter in the ancient Greeks, you know, even though it's disturbing, we can think, oh, well, that's past. That's gone away. We don't do that in the same way perhaps anymore. So how did it feel as you got closer to contemporary times? I mean, you divided into different kinds of groups and individuals, kings, conquerors, psychopaths. Did the type of personality change, or did we just call them different things?
We call them different things. Mm-hmm. We speak of kings in the past, and today we speak of political strongmen and dictators. But when you look at the record, they're playing the same game, and they're playing the same game that mobsters play. One of the things, by the way, you were talking about influences. You know, Hugh Thompson lived here in Lafayette. The man.
He's been in our studios before.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and what a puzzle he was. He was an admitted alcoholic. He was admittedly not a good father or husband. He was a funeral director, and he stopped the My Lai massacre probably single-handedly. And I asked someone at the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership in the United States Naval Academy, the historian there. I said, was he the first person in history to defend civilians against his own troops and live to tell about it? And the guy thought about it. He said, yeah, he probably was. So here is a modern American slaughter. And it's still going on. You hear things emerging from Iraq and Afghanistan of things our troops do. I think by and large our troops do a fabulous job. I think they do bring the American ideals of equality and human dignity with them. But we're still people, and it is warfare, and horrific things happen.
I want to tell people who may just be tuning in, my guest is Joe Abraham. His book, Kings, Conquerors, Psychopaths, From Alexander to Hitler to the Corporation, has just been published by the UL Press. There is a book signing this evening, actually at 5 o'clock, not too long after you leave here, and it will be in Lafayette at Marcello's.
The restaurant, not the restaurant. Wine market.
Okay. That's on Kali Saloom.
Yes.
On Kali Saloom. So 5 o'clock, you can talk with Joe Abraham about his book, get a copy of the book. And it's the history in it is fascinating. And I have to say, one of the individuals or time periods that I don't know if it surprised me, but your detail was astonishing. Was about the Napoleonic Wars. Because we're from Louisiana, we talk about Napoleon in a variety of ways. Oh, he almost came to St. Martinville. We live under the Napoleonic Code. It feels very close to us, and we speak admiringly sometimes of him, but that was a pretty difficult part of the book to read, what his armies did. And was that research surprising to you?
It was surprising in the intensity. I knew what warfare had to be. I had heard from Monte and from others that Monte Alain, we mentioned her earlier, that Napoleon was not a very nice person. There is one author, I think his name is escaping me, and that chapter on Napoleon, or that section on Napoleon, came almost exclusively or largely from one paper that I cite in the book. It makes me shudder, and it was recounting the Napoleonic Wars. And the intensity, yes, surprised me.
And when you say warfare, immediately we think of those paintings of Napoleon against the British and the horses, and it all does look very glorious. But a lot of these examples you're using are of civilian slaughter that are really difficult to read.
Yeah, our romantic notions are that these two armies will go out and meet in the countryside, and it's like a big game of risk with weapons, and the civilians are left alone. The civilians are the whole point of it. The civilians have the wealth. this, it's the capturing of cities. It's the looting of cities. That's where the fabulous wealth comes from. And so one of the horrific ones that I start with is the 1799 Siege of Jaffa near present-day Tel Aviv. Napoleon sent in negotiators to broker a ceasefire, and their heads appeared on the rampart. And when they broke through, Napoleon ordered complete annihilation. And it was just horrific. I don't know how much you want me to go into the details
here. Well, not
here.
A lot, but I feel like I was
safe for family.
I felt like I was reading something during the Crusades or 1,000 years before, you know. And I think that's one thing over and over again you feel when you're reading this book. You begin in faraway history, but we begin to realize reading this book that it comes so close to our present day. And that's an amazing story that you have to tell. Were there things that you felt like, I mean, you started taking notes many years ago about these historical events, these historical characters. Were there some conclusions that you felt you came to yourself that were helpful, horrifying? What was your experience when you came to the conclusion of writing this book personally?
The book does end on a positive note. 1776 changes everything. And one of the things – and again, I'm trying to figure out the Cajuns and Creoles and what is so amazing about this culture. And to a certain extent, you and I are both a little bit of outsiders. I don't know, you know.
I'm a Broussard.
Oh, I did. That's right. Your mom's a Broussard. My apologies. But we kind of come out of different traditions, and I think we're amazed looking at it. And so anyway, the point is, in 1776, we got rid of the bullies and genius spontaneously emerged. That's the lesson. It's true for our children. If you let them develop, genius is natural and spontaneous. And it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. If you took the Pharaoh and you transport him to 1776, he would certainly be impressed, but there would be little he wouldn't understand. Think if you took one of the founders of this country and brought him in the modern world, and if he were of a particular religious bent, he would see the diabolical everywhere he looked. That's what happened in a brief 240 years, I think, of getting rid of these horrific men, occasionally women, but most often men, at the top. Genius and progress are spontaneous.
But that's interesting how you say that everything changed in 1766, and I imagine also you're referring, we did celebrate Constitution Day yesterday,
oh, yeah,
the actual
right.
putting down on paper how we hope to prevent bullying and these horrific things that happen. But you do make the point that I think many people do try to make, that the piece of paper means nothing unless, as you say, the other branch, we the people, do make sure that it lasts.
I think that's one of our problems.
So there is hope. I would say there's a lot of difficult history to get through before you do get to that hope. But there is. You're right. History does change. And I guess I always think of George Santayana's quote, which I think is often forgotten, those that forget history are condemned to repeat it. And so your book is doing its best and its job to help us remember those histories, and that it's not just so far away, but there are those patterns that we have allowed at times to repeat themselves. And so a wonderful addition to those books these days that are trying to help us not repeat those patterns. Again, my guest, Joe Abraham, his book, Kings, Conquerors, Psychopaths, From Alexander to Hitler to the Corporation, has just been published by the UL Press. You can find out more through their website. You can also go to the book signing this evening, 5 o'clock. Joe will be there with his books, signing books, talking about his book. I'm glad to get into conversations with you. And that will be at Marcello's on Kali Saloon, the restaurant. So anything else to add, Joe?
You can find out a little bit more. You can see an outline of the book on my blog, bookscrounger.com. And, you know, I would like to also say that I certainly hope the book will be a success, but I hope it spurs more local people to write.
All right. There's a great challenge. Thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to pianist Christopher O'Reilly there performing the music of Radiohead, we heard Paranoid Android. You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette Lake Charles, coming up at 4 o'clock. It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support comes from the Hilliard University Art Museum, currently featuring the exhibit A. Hayestown and the Architectural Image of Louisiana, with A. Hayestown Home Tours in Baton Rouge on October 21st. Also presenting Creative Conversations, featuring art, music, film, and more every Wednesday evening. The Hilliard University Art Museum. Great art, good company. More at hilliardmuseum.org.
Get yourself a Titasta Cafe and drop a quarter into La Lu Jukebox with me, your host, Blake Miller, right here on your favorite radio station, KRVS.
Every Saturday night at 6 and Sunday morning at 7 here on KRVS.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.